I'd like now to welcome back to the program Aaron Stern. He's founder and president of the Academy for the Love of Learning, and the campus opening and consecration is this coming Saturday, the 5th of May from 10 to 3 at the campus at Seton Village. Welcome back to the cafe.
Thank you. Very good to be here.
So the Academy for the Love of Learning is doing all sorts of programs, but the foundation of it is based in some ways, a reaction to other models of education that we have in our society.
Yes, I think I would not use the word reaction as much as a response. It could easily become a reaction, but it, you know, the Academy was founded actually out of a question that was asked of me by my mentor, Leonard Bernstein, and the question was, don't we never learn? And that kind of deep question that he asked really had to do with, are we able to transform ourselves as human beings, or are we not? Are we growing, or are we not? Are we becoming better at being human beings, or are we not?
Which is a profound question, and it's both an individual and a collective question. And when I think about that, which I do myself quite often, It seems to me that there are so many people who, on an individual level, really are learning, growing, becoming more conscious, becoming kinder, and becoming more compassionate and things like that. But it doesn't affect the collective nearly as much as we think it should or hope it would.
The need for it to. At least we think so. I think that's really well put. It's a very important question. It's almost as if developmentally we've become very good at becoming I, but not very good at we.
And even those of us who maybe affect our small community around us, somehow those mafias and those power structures really don't care how much we evolve personally.
That's right. Yeah, they're very good at doing what they do.
Yeah. So, but tell us more about what's going on at the Academy and what the philosophy is behind it.
Well, I think one of the key principles that came out of that initiating question of Bernstein's, at that time, I was just then the dean of a college of music, and I was looking at how music students learn music, and I was quite occupied with the concern that music itself was sort of stalled at that time. This was in the late 70s, early 1980s. And there didn't seem to be anything new happening. We were kind of in a lull.
In classical music
in classical music. And I became quite interested in how students were learning music, and in particular, how students were being taught music. And a lot of it had to do with imitation. A lot of it had to do with the inhalation and regurgitation of all that has come before. And, of course, all of that is necessary, but it was taught in a rather rote way, in a rather theoretical way. And I became quite interested in methods that would begin with discovery and experimentation and improvisation, and from there, finding ways to connect students to history and various traditions. So that it's not that they didn't learn them, but they learned them as an adjunct to what they were already doing in their own voices and with their own discovery, and that became a very important principle for me that now sits at the center of the Academy. I think the basic principle being, we have to come back to experience now. We have been so occupied, our minds have been so occupied, even in some people's language, colonized by the thoughts of others, that we have to find a way to freshen. We have to find a way to reset, to use computer language, and come back to our own voices and touchstones internally. And that became a very important principle that lives in the work now.
There is kind of a dialectic, though, isn't there? Because, I mean, when you think about art or music or any kind of creative expression, the people who are best at it seem to be people who are very much grounded in what did come before.
Right. Yeah, well, that's a good way to say it. So, for example, I remember working with those early music students, and they would be these garage band musicians. What was the name of that film? Ted and Somebody's Terrific Adventure. Forgot the name
Bill
of
it. Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
That's it. And, you know, they were they had no contact with Socrates, as they called him, and who, of course, we knew was Socrates. And But they didn't have a grounding in history, but it seemed like they were very enthusiastic musicians. And so I often would encounter these very enthusiastic musicians who they did the most amazing things. They would do things like bum ba da da dum bum bum ba da 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 da, and I would look at them and say, "How did you get there?" And in that moment, I learned that I could point them to how cadences and phrases, let's say, would end, and a cadence would be created by Beethoven, because he was solving a similar problem in his Third Symphony, let's say. And in that moment, I could say to the student, would you be interested to see how Beethoven solved that same musical problem in his Third Symphony? And suddenly they're in a dialogue with Beethoven. And in a way, my work is done then. Because then they're studying what Beethoven did, comparing it to what they do, and they begin to learn aesthetically what beauty is and why, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's a matter of sequencing. And I think, unfortunately, human beings are quite imitative. And fortunately, we're quite imitative. So there's that dialectic again. And right now, at the time in this particular juncture, I feel really deeply that we simply have to tip the balance back to experience and discovery, and then bring people into didactic study and study of history.
Now, are you talking about children, adults?
Everybody, all of us, you know.
And what does that look like at the academy? Give us an example from maybe a class or a series that you're doing.
Great question. Let's look at the teacher renewal program. We've now had more than 200 public school teachers come through this particular program. It's a wonderful program. It's a series of 3 workshops in the fall, 3 workshops in the spring. After the workshops are complete, the teachers are then invited into wisdom circles, they call them, which are peer-to-peer circles, where they're actually just studying, teaching, and learning, which is what they ought to be doing, as distinct from curriculum and delivering curriculum and teaching to tests.
Right.
They're actually studying their craft, and they're having a chance to be together in collegial conversations and sharing best practices, etc. Unfortunately, there aren't spaces for that very often in their schools. So we provide that as an opportunity.
What are some examples of best practices in elementary school teaching?
Well, from our perspective, most important is teachers being infected and in love with learning. They are exemplars, since kids imitate. If teachers are in a practice as educators and learning about how to teach better and how to meet children better, then children learn through example that that's what it means to be a human being. Because the hidden curriculum is the teacher, him or herself. That is the hidden curriculum in the classroom, who this person is. So becoming an exemplar and model of a person who loves to learn is a very important thing for children to witness.
What is the proper role, do you think, of memorization? And I ask that because in all the various manifestations of my own elementary school education and junior high and high school, memorization played a very positive role. It wasn't the only role, but it was very good for me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me turn it back to you. What did it do for you?
Well, memorizing, for example, your times tables, mm-hmm. or memorizing what enzymes are. Of course, mm-hmm. it's for the science test, but you know for the rest of your life what they are.
Right.
Or memorizing a poem. You have that poem to draw on for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm.
So when you talked about times table, I thought about rhythm. And I thought also when you were talking about poetry, the beauty of poetry, and there's something about memorization and simple beauty and verses and various forms of poetry. You know, for me, there are things that we can talk about the mind and how the brain works and about patterns and synapses and connections that get made. I think memorization is wonderful. In music, it plays a very important role. It's the last thing I do when I learn. I'm a musician, I should have said that, composer and performer of music. And the last thing I do is memorize a piece.
What do you do before that?
I play it. I play with it. I express it. I fall in love with it. And then there's a certain point that I want to share it with other people. So I find that as I've been going through it, I have been memorizing it. I think the other side of the coin is if you begin by memorizing it, you can memorize it and put it away and never do another thing with it. So the falling in love step kind of gets skipped.
Oh, very interesting. Now, do you think, using that example, is that a learning style, or do you think everybody's like that? I mean, if they were to
falling
really...
Falling in love?
Well, in other words, doing the memorization last. I mean, I could imagine, maybe I'm wrong, though, you know, a kind of person who memorizes it first and then has that grasp of it and falls in love with it afterwards.
I think it's about half and half. And my sense of it is that some people feel more comfortable and more capable of memorization, and there are certain things. I can remember Mohs chart of hardness, for example,
what?
From talc, gypsum, I won't even go through the whole, bore you with the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But now, do I really know what talc feels like and gypsum feels like, et cetera, et cetera? I would say no. I mean, diamond, I don't even know what half of these things are.
Isn't that interesting? Because exactly the things that you're talking about, we had samples of in Mr. Chaput's fourth grade class in my elementary school, and we felt talc, and we felt gypsum, and we peeled things apart and knocked on them and pushed them around and stuff like that. And so you remember those particular minerals for the rest of your life.
Well, and what I'm interested in is that you remember the teacher's name.
I wrote to him a few years ago because he changed my life. He changed everybody in that fourth grade's class life.
So there is an example of a teacher that understood the power of discovery and the power of touch, and that memorization in itself wasn't going to be enough.
Right.
So it's interesting that it comes back down to the teacher and who the teacher is. And what is that teacher's relationship to learning in particular, and discovery, and the magic of the not yet known, and the wonder that sits inside that? And that is actually at the core of our teacher renewal program, just to come back to that, because we place teachers and invite them into those kinds of experiences again as learners. We then have them reflect on what was potent about that kind of experience. And then out of that, they refine their own philosophies and practices as teachers. And they bring that back into the classroom and revivify the classroom.
Do you
and
see
it's working.
That happening? I was going to say, do you go visit
yes.
the classrooms?
Absolutely. Well, sure. And we have another, you know Chrissy Orr, I believe.
Yeah.
We have Chrissy on our faculty, and we have the El Otro Lado project, which the academy's been involved with since the very start of that project in this community. And that project is now being implemented through the teachers and the teacher renewal program. They're bringing it into the classrooms with the kids. So we have, I think, 9 now teaching artists who are working in 9 different schools in the community, working with children, working with teachers, and we're seeing all that wonder come alive and revivify.
Right. Well, I mean, but do you also, those kinds of teachers, and we've all had them and we all know them, people who are so burned out and so tired and disgusted, do any of those people ever come into your...
Many of them do. And, you know, one of the things, this summer, our summer teacher, so I mentioned that we have these workshops, so they're 3 in the fall, 3 in the spring, and after they go through the sequence of 3, and they're Saturday all day long, they go into wisdom circles, and those wisdom circles are peer-to-peer, and they're, you know, best practice experts.
Like one-to-one?
No, groups of maybe 8 or 12 or 6, depends on who's there. And then... it culminates in the summer with the Summer Institute for Teachers that's several days long out, you know, at the academy. And last summer, we introduced them to the El Otro Lado methodology, and from there, they took it into their classrooms this year, and they're working with the children. So it just keeps getting more and more embedded, this love of learning, this aliveness, this meeting of human being, and it's infecting everybody in the schools. We've even had one whole school ask if we could take the teacher renewal program and implement it school-wide in a single school in the community. So, you know, aliveness is infectious, and we all have our thresholds and our abilities and capacities to stretch more and more into our aliveness, but that's actually what matters most. Do we have alive teachers, and are they transmitting and inviting the aliveness of kids?
And the other word that's in there is love.
Love, absolutely. Absolutely. It was the name of the academy came from Bernstein, and he called me up one night at about 4 o'clock in the morning in New York, and he said, well, I have the name of our thing, as he called it. And I said, oh, really? What is it? And he said, it's the Academy for the Love of Learning. All, A-L-L. Because you believe that if you just take the lid off learning, we will learn ourselves to a better world. And I said, I do. That's absolutely what I believe. And I hate the name. It's too long, and it's too hard to say, and it's totally pretentious. And he said, well, that's because I thought of it first, and he hung up on me. And that, but in fact, it is the right name, and that was before email, and that was before aloveoflearning.org, which is quite a mouthful.
Right.
But it's a beautiful name, and it touches people, and love is in the name, and learning is in the name. And actually, it's the most passionate thing that we do, curiosity. And I don't mean intellectual curiosity. If you think of an infant stretching up and looking out into the world, if there were words, it would be, what is it? What is it? What is it? What is it? If our mission was ever accomplished, and this is a 300-year project, I think our mission would be accomplished if we all walked around looking into the world with that kind of wonder, and also looking internally at our internal worlds with that kind of wonder. Who am I? Why am I here?
Well, and I think eventually that combines with intellectual curiosity. Like, I don't think that that has to be a kind of separate entity.
I agree. It motivates intellectual curiosity. It's integrated. I agree.
We're talking to Aaron Stern. He's founder and president of the Academy for the Love of Learning. Now, you are having a campus opening. I thought your campus was already open.
We've been functioning in the campus since March 2nd, I think, of 2011.
Oh, okay.
Growing into it.
Yeah.
So we're having, and we've had various events. We didn't want to have just one big, huge splash. We've had just, as we've opened different parts of our buildings, we've had different events. So when the Seton Gallery opened in the summer, we had a lovely event. There were a couple of hundred people there. Now, this is the formal consecration of the building, and the mayor will be there, and our many, many friends. Frances Moore LePay, you probably know of her.
Yeah,
she'll
yeah.
be there, and Matthew Fox, who is our scholar, our visiting scholar, will be there, and I said Mayor Koss will be there, and David Abram will be there, and some of our local heroes will be there, and heroines, and so we and Kathy Sanchez from the San Ildefonso Pueblo will be there with her husband, leading us in a beautiful ceremony. We'll be turning to history and honoring the past of those who've lived here and been on the land, and asking for their blessings in bringing our blessings in respect. And then we'll turn towards the future and a dedication of our work to future generations and what we're trying to accomplish, and plant a beautiful tree. And also a tree that will go to the Pueblo simultaneously. And a beautiful thing is there will be some young people there, and we're supporting a group of five kids or five community members who will go to a beautiful ceremony at the mouth of the Mississippi River this summer. And it's called Wiping Away the Tears. And it's an indigenous peoples from different parts of this country who will be there, turning back, much as we're doing, in respect to the past, but also letting go of that what's holding them back from moving forward and bringing the important contribution that they have to bring into the world now. So it's a beautiful ceremony, and those kids will come back to the Academy in August when we have our next little event, which is the commemoration of the birthday of Ernest Thompson Seton, on whose land we now exist.
Right, and who was honored with a terrific exhibition at the New Mexico History Museum. That's, I think, right. It was last year.
Last year, that's yeah. Right. It ended in May of last year. It was their first big impermanent exhibit, and we sponsored it. There was just a magnificent exhibit. And so that exhibit, many of the pieces of that exhibit are in the Seton Archives now at the Academy.
Ah, nice.
So people will be able to visit that on a regular basis now.
So the event is this coming Saturday, the 5th of May, from 10 to 3. Mm-hmm. It's free to the public, and people can just, it's a long day, so people can just sort of go in and out? Or
well, it's the thing, I'm glad you asked that. It will begin at 10 with the ceremony outside, and with Kathy Sanchez leading it, so that'll be kind of a one segment, and that'll end with the planting of the tree, and that'll go until about 11:30. And then we'll go inside the building and we'll have a beautiful giving testimony by many of our guests and people that are present in our main room called the Bernstein Room. And we'll talk about learning and waking up and the relationship. And people will just bring little stories and vignettes of what that means to them in their lives. And there will be an opportunity to go to our learning landscape and have a tour of that, which is this beautiful thing that we're doing in collaboration with Christy Green, who lives here in Santa Fe. And it's a beautiful way that we're looking at the landscape, that we're always learning from the land what it wants of us and developing our whole landscaping approach in relationship to deep listening, deep awareness, and being allowing the deep touching of nature and inviting that so that we work respectfully. And I think the building, so that'll take us till 3 o'clock. So
the themes I'm getting today are love, listening, and also beauty.
Yes, very much so. An aesthetic way of life.
Yeah. The Academy for the Love of Learning is on the web at aloveoflearning.org. Aaron Stern is the founder and president. Thank you so much for being with us, and we look forward to seeing you on Saturday.
Thank you. Good to see you.
I'm very happy now to welcome Isabel Ribe. She is with the Adelante program in the Santa Fe Public Schools and here to talk about the Youth Creating Change Film Festival, which is happening this Saturday, the 5th of May at 6:30 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So a film festival, all young people from the Santa Fe Public Schools participating?
Mm-hmm. Yep. We have about 16 films that are going to be shown, and they're all completely conceived of and produced by young people in the school system. Most of them are from Santa Fe High and Capitol High, but we also have involvement from the Youth Allies program at EarthCare.
And what are the films about? I take it you've seen all of them and maybe even been involved in producing them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a huge range of subject matter, and they're still actually pouring in. Oh, the submissions are still coming in. We have a film about what it's like to be an undocumented student in the public school system. We have a film about population in the world in general. We have a film about climate change. There's a film about Food Not Bombs, which is a program that serves food to homeless people in the park.
Yeah, we've had Keith McHenry on many times.
Oh, yeah, right.
And
on.
He's amazing.
Yeah, we have a film about, he's actually interviewed in the film. Then we also have a film for Adelante, which was created by a 14-year-old Capitol High student about her and her family's experience being homeless in Santa Fe, and she also profiles some other families who have been experiencing homelessness in Santa Fe. So that's sort of my favorite one because it's about Adelante, but that's just because I was picking favorites.
So how are they learning to make films?
So we've been working on this project since about January, sort of intensely. What we did was that we put on a workshop, a filmmaking workshop at Warehouse 21, and we had professional filmmakers come, and we taught about storytelling and then some nuts and bolts filmmaking stuff, and then we set up the youth who came to that workshop with mentors, with filmmaking mentors, and had them conceive of their project and go out into the world and start filming. So some of the films have came out of that process. We also have films that came out of teachers at the high schools who wanted to get involved and started doing work with their students.
And did they have access to equipment and software and all that stuff?
Kind of. We did this entire thing with a budget of about $100, which was spent on pizza for the workshop. So we actually got a bunch of flip cams from TechSoup and passed those around.
What's TechSoup?
TechSoup is a... It's a website that provides discounted software and technology for nonprofits. So we got a deal from them on a bunch of flip cams and sort of passed those out. And everything else is totally on the fly, who has what on whose computer, who has what software. And it's working with nothing and being creative with what you have. But it's actually really incredible because what's coming in is super good quality and really, really top notch.
And not only brings all of these different issues to the attention of viewers and everything, but gets these young people involved in a craft.
Mm-hmm.
And
exactly.
I think mastering any craft in high school is just really good for you.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And also having the experience of getting something done out of your own volition. That's not necessarily for school, but you become passionate about something, you do all this work, and then you can see this final project, this final product, which is then put on in front of a whole bunch of people who can witness it.
So you are with the Adelante program. We're talking to Isabel Ribe about the Youth Creating Change Film Festival, which is coming up on Saturday, but you're part of a much bigger thing, which is this Adelante program. What's it all about?
Well, the Adelante program, we are part of the Santa Fe Public School District, and we serve serve children and youth experiencing homelessness in Santa Fe and their families. Every year we serve about 1,500, maybe a little bit less, students and their families. We provide a whole gamut of services, including everything from tutoring and school supplies, winter coats, case management. We provide emergency funds to prevent utility disconnect and to prevent eviction. We also have a weekly program on Thursday evenings called Juntos los Jueves, where we give classes on a variety of different things like financial literacy and parenting and nutrition. And we give out fresh groceries and do an art class for the kids every week. So it's really a community more than anything, a supportive community and very effective.
How does it change their lives? In other words, what are they doing differently?
There's a number of things. Part of it is that the people who work with Adelante, and in particular I'll mention Gail Herling, who's the coordinator of the program, are so incredibly dedicated and heartfelt about what they do, that the people who come into our office can really, really feel that. And that's sort of a different experience than they might have had in other places.
Yeah, going in to get a check from somewhere,
yeah,
and not having a human connection.
Mm-hmm. And that's really what it's all about, more than anything, is creating that human connection. And the services that we provide are kind of come after that. It's kind of like, so I think that's part of it, is just that they come and they know that somebody cares about them and that is there to help them. Because everybody in the staff is amazingly dedicated and on a real heart level. So I would say that's the most important thing that makes a change in people's lives.
That's so interesting. And I think it's very important because it underlines the reality that all of life, whatever our infrastructures are and all those things, which are, to be sure, important, at the bottom is human relationships.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And animal-human relationships and things like that. We're talking to Isabel Ribe. So this film festival is happening this Friday. This Saturday, thank you. And do you have young people who... First of all, is it the first year that it's been done?
This is the first year it's been done in Santa Fe.
Okay.
It was done last year in Albuquerque. It had the same name. And there the films were primarily about hunger and homelessness in Albuquerque. So we decided to take this project on this year in Santa Fe, but to broaden the topic a little bit more so that youth could actually be making films about what they found important here in Santa Fe.
Do you have any kids who've gotten really excited about filmmaking and want to keep doing it?
Yeah, totally. I mean, actually just this morning, because I work at the Teen Parenting Center also, and we made a series of films with the girls to show at the festival, and just this morning we showed them their films. And they were so excited because they got to see the final product and their eyes just lit up. And it's like, once you see like the product and you've gone through the concept and you've gone through the work, it's intoxicating for these kids. And I've been seeing that, absolutely.
Are they going to take the films, once they're shown on Saturday, to any other places? Will they show them to, like, you know, government or any other agencies in town?
I think that actually depends on the project. I know there's particular projects, like there's one that's about waste in the schools and the Eco Schools project. I know that they are going to be using that to promote what they're doing with trying to reduce waste and compost and stuff like that at the school. I know that the film about Adelante will definitely be using in the future. So it kind of depends on the project.
You're also with the Teen Parent Center, as you said, at Santa Fe High School.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do there?
I do a variety of different things. In theory, I work on food access, but in practice, I kind of do whatever's needed in the moment. I do a lot of case management and mentoring. I do reading groups with the girls. We did this film project, which was a lot. We have a garden there, so we've been growing food and talking about sustainability. So a whole bunch of things, but...
Are there a lot of teen parents in the school?
Mm-hmm. At Santa Fe High, we have about 35 girls in the program right now. At Capital, there's about 12 right
Any
now.
Boys?
The program is for boys and girls, but we are all girls in the program.
Right.
There is also a program called Young Fathers of Santa Fe, which is like a support group that's run by a guy named Barry McIntosh. So there is some services available to the dads as well.
What's going on with teen pregnancy? Presumably, these are not planned pregnancies for the most part, or are they? Do they just not know what they're doing?
There's a whole range of experiences that the girls have. Some of them are actually married and have, you know, chosen pregnancy. Some of them are on their second pregnancy. But it's true that the majority of them are unplanned.
Do they not have sex education and birth control?
They do. In fact, at the teen health center in the high schools, they can get just about any kind of birth control for free. And they do have health classes as well, where they talk about all of the nuts and bolts and the realities of pregnancy and things like that. So it's, you know, it's hard to say exactly why it happens, but I think it's more individual to each girl and her particular experience and her particular circumstance.
Do you see young women who or teenage girls who are getting pregnant who don't want to be pregnant getting abortions? Does that happen?
No, not in our program at all. 100% of the girls who are in our program became pregnant and immediately knew that they were going to keep and raise the child. In fact, we haven't had a single student who even was considering adoption.
I didn't say adoption.
Oh, yeah. Adoption as well is also not considered, but abortion is absolutely not on the table.
Yeah.
For
Very
the girls that we work with.
Why is that, do you think?
It's an issue of culture and religion. It's just not part of the dialogue. It's not an option for these girls.
How are their children doing?
A lot of them are doing quite well. We also have there's a PMS daycare that's part of the part of the center. So most of the girls actually have their children there on campus in daycare, and it's a great it's a great service. So the babies in the program range from birth to about 5 years old.
Uh-huh. Isabel Ribe is with the Adelante program, which is part of the Santa Fe Public School System. And once again, the Youth Creating Change Film Festival is this Saturday, the 5th of May, at 6:30 at the Zona del Sol building, which is on the corner of Jaguar and Country Club on the south side in Santa Fe. And is there any place, if anyone wants more information, is there a website or a number they can call?
They can call me at 819-9966, and I'd love to answer any questions. We'd love to see you all there.
Isabel, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Mona Malik and Charles Thomas. Charles Thomas is the athletic director of the 24th annual Rio Grande Valley Celtic Festival and Highland Games, which will be held on May 19th and 20th at the Balloon Fiesta Park in Albuquerque. Mona Malik is not only an actress who's been on this show many times, but an athlete in these games. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
And I'm happy to say that Charles came dressed in a kilt. This is a really amazing... I didn't know anything about this. I did not know that there were Celtic games, much less in New Mexico. But these are games that include a whole bunch of events, not a single one of which I'd ever heard of. The caber toss, the Scottish hammer throw, the stone put, the sheaf toss. What's it all about? Is it basically Scots getting together and throwing heavy things?
Well, it's a lot about that. I mean, testosterone obviously factored into it, you know, way back. But if you look back at the history of Scotland, Scotland was occupied for a large part of its history by England. And so, as an occupied country, in essence, they weren't allowed to maintain a standing army. So, with many societies that have had that kind of a situation, they develop means to train their men, their warriors, without having it look like actual military exercises. And so, the games came about as a means for the King of Scotland at the time to begin to have some sort of training program for the warriors to keep them in shape, keep them motivated, in the event that they ever had an opportunity to go to battle.
Very interesting. So they learn to do all these, again, what it looks like throwing heavy things, and tell us about what some of the activities actually are.
All right. Well, most of the events, in fact, all of the events really came out of the society at the time. If you look back in the 1400s, it was much a different society than we have today, and so much more physical labor elements. So the sheaf toss, for example, not sheep, which is one of the things that the first people think.
It is not a sheep toss.
It's not a sheep toss. It's a sheaf, like a sheaf of wheat.
As in the sheaves, right.
Yes. So when you would harvest the sheaves of wheat, as the wagon went around, you would throw them onto the wagon. Well, the more sheaves you could load onto the wagon, the less trips you had to make out into the field. And so the higher you could throw them, the higher you could stack them. And so it became its own competition and a skill set. And so they brought all of these events together from the agrarian society that they had at the time and kind of molded them in. These were kind of tests of skill and of strength that the working class had kind of used in the fields and whatnot. Like the throws, the hammer throws. I mean, very simply, when they were putting posts in the field, you had a large sledgehammer to drive the posts, and if you wanted to get it to somebody in the next field over, you could walk the hammer over, or you could throw the hammer to them.
Right.
And so many of these all came from, a lot of day-to-day application that they had at the time.
Very interesting. So how did they get codified into actual games? Are these things that are done in Scotland and in festivals all over the world? Or?
Oh, yeah. They are actual official games. They all have essential rules that have been in place, I want to say, since about the late 1400s, when the King of Scotland, and his name escapes me, unfortunately, but when he kind of announced or decided to have the first games, they put these in as codified events and set them in. So there's 9 total events. You are required to compete kilted, so everyone has to wear a kilt out on the field.
And what about the females? I mean, you, Mona, are going to be out there kilted doing this. Is it the same events?
It is exactly the same events. The only difference is the weights. And so men throw heavier weights, and there's actually classes for weight. So there's a men's class that's under 190, is that right?
That's correct.
And then there are master's classes, so that's athletes over the age of 40. And so they all have their own set of weights that they use. So I don't have to throw what Chuck has to throw.
And are there age differences also in the women's class?
Yes, there are. There is. And that depends on the games and how many women compete and probably how long the games have been going on and how big the classes are. So in Albuquerque, there's a master's class, and there was a master's class in Tucson as well, when I threw in Tucson. But the games I just threw at this weekend, there was just a women's class, and so there isn't that delineation for age in all the games.
How did you learn to do this, and how did you each get into it?
Well, actually, Chuck has been a friend of my husband for a really, really long time, and I had started working out about 2 years ago and thought, well, great, I can go to the gym. And so, and I'm not a runner. I couldn't figure out what else I wanted to do, and my husband reminded me, oh, I think Chuck throws that Scottish stuff. And so I sent him an email, and he sent me a whole bunch of information about it, and I looked at it and went, uh-huh, yeah, and put it away for a couple months, and then I showed up at a practice, about last March, probably.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been throwing a little bit more than a year.
And what do you throw?
Well, same stuff. Hammers, weight for distance, weight over bar, cabers, so wood and metal is what we throw.
Pretty much.
The weight over bar, it's like a pole vault bar, and you have to throw the weight over the bar and also not knock the bar off.
Yeah, and that depends on the game. Some of the games have fixed bars, and some have bars that will actually fall away if you knock into it. And we used a fixed bar in Albuquerque.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, we use a fixed bar. The traditional games use a knockoff bar, and it will lower the weight, the height, obviously, that you can get, because if you touch it, generally you're knocking it off or breaking it. But it also stretches out the length of the games, so a lot of the games, for convenience sake, will use a fixed bar.
Now, how did you get into this whole throwing business?
Well, I actually got started in Strongman back at about 2000.
And Strongman?
Strongman competitions, like you see, like World's Strongest Man with the Atlas Stones and all of that. So I had competed in that for several years, and at one competition, somebody had mentioned, hey, next week there's a Scottish festival in Rio Rancho. You should go check it out and compete. And I'm like, oh, okay. So I went out there, and, you know, you're walking on the field and kind of seeing all these guys in kilts throwing things, which was definitely something I hadn't seen before. But the thing that kind of struck me with from my first competition was seeing, found out later it was Wayne Staggs from Colorado, who's an older gentleman. He's 63 now, so he was in his early 50s when I started. And he was throwing the caber and basically destroying anyone else in terms of his skill level. And so it struck me, as opposed to strongman, which has a very limited, you know, time frame that you can actually compete in it competitively, if you can be competing and improving and doing well into your 50s and 60s, that really attracted me to the sport.
And so you pretty much throw the sheaves and the stones and the hammers and the cabers and everything else.
Yes, every games will usually have between 7 and 9 events. So there's a possibility of having 2 stones, 2 hammers, 2 weight for distance. These are all light and heavy variants of each other. The sheaf toss, the caber toss, and the weight over bar.
How do you train for this in such a way that you don't get injured?
Well, I think, you know, injuries really aren't – serious injuries are not that common in the sport. I will say anytime you're lifting, you know, heavily implements and doing the kind of explosive training, there's always going to be tweaks and injuries you acquire. But you go out in your backyard and chop down your tree. No.
And then throw it.
No, you try to find somebody. Luckily, when I got started in the sport, there was somebody local, Grant Oliver, who had the equipment. And so we have a practice that we do every Sunday at Valley Pool Park down in Albuquerque, and we invite everybody to come out and to participate. And we rotate through all the events week by week so that everybody has a chance to kind of train on all the implements.
Now, in addition to all of this throwing and all of the different events and different sub-events, different ages and so on, there's also beer, whiskey, and haggis. Is that right?
That's correct. We've got a lot of that at the festival. In fact, this year we've got 2 new things that hadn't been at the festival. We have a whiskey tasting that's scheduled to go on, so Scotch whiskey.
Like a wine tasting, only whiskey, like, yeah.
Yeah, with various Scotch, and I'm trying to think, that's Two Fools that's sponsoring that. And then we talked to the Brewers Guild, and they're actually putting on a brewing competition at the games. So they'll be providing, you know, homebrew beer as a competition that the Brewers Guild is doing. So that's a new event this year as well.
There are also, I mean, there's this whole Scottish element to it in the sense that, well, let me ask you, how many people who compete are actually Scottish or of Scottish origin?
A large number are of Scottish origin. I mean, it depends on how far back you want to go and kind of the history of your family to find it. But a lot of folks can trace their ancestry back. But that's not a requirement to compete. We have a lot of local competitors who are not Scottish.
Like Mona,
who will come out and compete. And that's great. We welcome everybody to come out and compete. I mean, a lot of it is the camaraderie. It's the whole nature of the sport that we want to encourage everybody to come out and try it out and throw and have a good time. So, I mean, the Scottish heritage part is really nice. But it's not like the clan tents, which are set up for a clan, by a clan, and they're promoting the actual clan history. We're looking at the sport, which is a Scottish-based sport, and we're trying to broaden it out and make sure that everybody's included and can compete if they'd like to.
But there are clan tents.
Yes. Yeah, there are. Will be a number of clan tents throughout the festival for all the various clans that have representation locally, and I believe some will be coming in from out of state.
And you only get to go in if you're in the clan?
No, anybody can go in. All the clans tend to promote their history and just kind of tell you a little bit about themselves. But anybody can kind of go in. They'll usually try to help you because they'll have succession of names and whatnot. So if you're curious if you belong to which clan, you can go research your name. They'll have some various tents set up that are just kind of, we'll do the clan research. They'll have all the tartans laid out so that you can kind of find out what your tartan is for your clan. It's pretty neat.
Now, let's say that you win one of the competitions. Do you then have the opportunity to go on to regionals or nationals or anything like that? Is it set up like that?
It's not quite set up like that. Most of the Scottish games are fairly independent. There are a number of like the World's Masters Champions, which Mona is going to be competing at next week.
I am in South Carolina. Next month.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness.
They require you to have a minimum of five recognized games in the previous year so that you've shown that you're an active competitor at sanctioned events. But as far as like an NCAA where you have a regional setup or anything like that, it's much more informal in terms of the games.
So it's really above all the love of the game.
Exactly.
Which really, I mean, you can see on the field. It is the only sport I think I've seen where, you know, someone who's chasing you or chasing your number or is better than you will come up and tell you, you know, if you just bend your knees a little bit more, this is going to give you that extra inch, you know, and people will coach each other and help each other, and it is the most encouraging thing I've seen ever.
Even the person who wants to beat you will be...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's all about just doing your best and beating your own numbers. And everyone, my experience has been that everyone is there to help you do that because that's what they want to do too. And they'll often turn and say, What'd you see? Did I straighten my arm that time or did I bend my elbow that time? And so it's a very supportive and very competitive environment. It's pretty unique.
And of course, no Celtic festival would be complete without bagpipes.
Oh yeah, you'll get to hear plenty of bagpipes. They have a piping competition usually at the games, so they'll be doing various numbers, none of which I could really name, but
or God forbid, sing.
Exactly. But that's going on all throughout the festival, so you get a real experience of Scotland when you're there. Just from hearing that, the bagpipes are mm-hmm. so unique and so original. That while you're competing or having lunch or just wandering around the festival, there's always bagpiping going on, and it's such a unique sound. I really like it. It's great to kind of get immersed in that and have that around you as you're competing. It just adds to it.
What strikes me about this whole thing is it's big. Big people, big weights, big food, big sounds. I mean, it's really a massive sport.
It can be. We do have a number of classes, though, that are for everyone. We have the under 190 class for men, so it's a lightweight men's class, so you can compete on a weight base as opposed to a skill base. And having said that, there are several, I mean, Johnny Stone, who currently holds the record, I believe, through the sheaf 29 feet as an under 190 athlete.
How much does the sheaf weigh?
For the lightweight men, it would be 16 pounds.
So throwing a 16-pound thing... 29 feet.
That's correct.
Yeah. That's a long way to throw a 16-pound
thing.
That's up in the air,
over your head. So.
And that has to go over the crossbar. So there's certainly an element of accuracy that works mm-hmm. into that event as well. So you can't just throw it high up in the air. You have to get it over the crossbar.
Right.
One of the most joyous things you'll learn as a kind of a statement when you'll hear that, oh, you had the height.
You had the height.
Yeah. Which is always kind of a...
Those are the dreaded words, because it isn't just muscling something up. It isn't just about the power. It's about the accuracy. I mean, the event that a lot of people will know is the caber, the pole, the most dramatic event. That is all about accuracy, because it's not about how far you throw it, how high you throw it, but whether or not you throw it accurately at 12 o'clock, because it's graded... It's graded on a clock,
right.
And so it has to fall perfectly at noon. It looks like it's all just power and throwing your weight around, but it really is a skill. It really is a skill-based event. All of them are.
Mm-hmm.
All about form.
There's a great website, which is KeltFestABQ.com. And not only can you find out about the Rio Grande Valley Celtic Festival, but you can also see pictures of people involved in these events, and they're beautiful. Mm-hmm. They're pictures of super, super buff dudes in kilts holding rocks about to throw them and things like that. It's definitely worth checking out.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for being here. Charles Thomas is the athletic director. Mona Malik is an athlete at the 24th annual Rio Grande Valley Celtic Festival and Highland Games. Once again, it's May 19th and 20th at Balloon Fiesta Park in Albuquerque. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having
us. Thanks
so
much.
We appreciate it.